Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So hi, this is Gavin from FE News, and I've got a great pleasure to be joined with a coffee and a chat with Kirsty Donnelly from City & Guilds. Kirsty, how are you?
I'm good, Gavin. How are you for February? I'm just delighted that we've got out of January. January felt like the longest month ever. It was on elastic.
It was the longest month ever. What a start to the year. But we've got a lot of really interesting stuff to cover today. This week is National Apprenticeship Week. In a lockdown, which is interesting. Yep. I also wanted to chat to you around the Skills for Job white paper, the long anticipated FE white paper. But it was with about 5 million other announcements all at the same time. I've never seen so many at once. And also, you've recently released a really interesting report, which is just literally brilliant timing, the Building Bridges Towards the Future Jobs report. And I think everything that we're around is what's the future of jobs, what are the skills needed for those, what is the education system to deliver that, and now more than ever we seem to need that. So it's this really, really brilliant timing for the report, and I was just wondering if we could unpack that a little bit more.
Great.
But first of all, you said before we started pressing record really around the interesting time of the National Apprenticeship Week, particularly being during the week of love, and what does it mean? So how can we as a sector take things forward with apprenticeships? How could that, sort of move forward, particularly in the lockdown sort of situation? Because as you rightly said, pre-record is that apprenticeships have been here long before COVID and are going to be long after. How can we sort of nurture that in the sector and drive this forward?
Yeah, no, great. In fact, you've taken all my lines there then, Gavin. but as you've just sort of said, as we were chatting before we came on air, so to speak, I'm delighted, actually. It's so timely that we are celebrating apprenticeships this week, because in a moment of it being Valentine's, for those of us who believe in that, I think we all need those little moments now, don't we? You know, I think Valentine's is probably going to be an incredibly popular day, even though it'll be lockdown Valentine's. I can imagine the takeaways going ballistic. But but joking apart, the fact that, we do need to fuel some love back into apprenticeships, there's no doubt in my mind about that. I mean, apprenticeships have taken a huge hammering through as a result of the lockdown, despite a lot of employers' best efforts and despite a lot of apprentices themselves who have found themselves in very difficult situations, not being able to complete their apprenticeship or even finding that they're not actually going to be have a job at the end of it, and so on. So I think the opportunity is we start to look up and ahead, and I'm the optimist here. I'm glasses half full. I'm looking towards the end of March, starting to get back out there. Lockdown starting to be lifted, this is a real opportunity to see apprenticeships as part of the post-COVID growth and recovery. And as I said before we came on air, I mean, apprenticeships go back centuries and they'll be here for centuries, and thank goodness that they will be, giving all that opportunity, hope and aspiration. But there is a but or an and, depending which way you want to look at it. We do need to think differently about what might need to be done to help employers continue to invest in apprenticeships. So, if you take the hospitality sector, where they've almost had basically a year where the levy's been taken, but, they've not been able to do anything despite wanting to. So, you know, can there be some kind of extension period so that they can then have an extension in order to be able to utilise the levy that they've already paid in over a longer period of time? Because that would then encourage them to take more apprentices as that recovery starts to happen. So I think it's just about finding really pragmatic ways of thinking about how do we just create some flexibilities to encourage employers that may be sort of just teetering on the edge of, well, do we continue to invest in apprenticeships or not? Do we just see it as a tax? Or, and actually, you know, as great as programs like the Kickstart program are for certain groups of learners, they don't replace the need for apprenticeships. But of course, employers may be tempted to think differently about Kickstart versus apprenticeship. So how can we even look at the two conflated in some way that actually allows one to be a stepping point into the other? So I think we do need to think about some different flexibilities to continue to grow apprenticeships.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think it's a really good point. Hopefully the powers that be, those real influencers, hopefully you're listening and can, Kirsty will be definitely up for a chat about this, but I think you're right. I think we need to be looking at flexibilities around the levy. If people have been paying it for a year, and they have, then yeah, how can we sort of utilise that in different ways? And I think it's great around the whole plan for jobs and, you know, what is brilliant is it's Rishi's project. He's literally knows where the magic money tree lives, which is amazing, and also holds the purse strings for the country. But, you know, the whole thing around Kickstart, Restart, traineeships, you know, really, can this be a pre-employment program? Can this be a pre-apprenticeship program to then be able to progress on? And basically everything he's saying is yes, which is fantastic. So it's this makes sense to be able to give those employers this help and to give them the learners, the people that are struggling to be able to find new roles at the moment. Because you've had the ONS details only the other day as well. You have 5% unemployment, which is a shocker with everything that's going on to try to keep that number away from being really huge. 250,000 young people, 250,000 more young people are out of work compared to before COVID. It's just really shocking numbers. So it's just, I think we need.
And it's only going to get, I mean, I don't mean to be doom and gloom. It is only going to get worse that. I mean, we have to face, you know, no point kidding ourselves. It's not going to get better before it gets worse, I suppose. And therefore, you mentioned the, you know, the proverbial money tree a moment ago, Gavin. But you know, it doesn't exist. If only it did. So in many respects, I think what both of us are saying, really, there's an opportunity here for government and government departments to come together and maximise existing resources. A lot of the things that we've talked to this past year in some of the Act Now research that we've done even last year wasn't actually even about looking for new money, although that's always welcome. And there are definitely areas where new money is needed. We'll get onto that later, I'm sure, like, for example, in adult and lifelong learning, that desperately needs some new money. But, I mean, this is about just using the existing money sensibly. So take the levy. It's existing funding, but let's think about how can the levy work even harder for both UK PLC, for employers, and for those individuals alongside the Kickstart money, so it sort of becomes a continuum. And so I just think it's about just a sort of reorientation and clever thinking around how we make what we've already got work harder for us by targeting it where it's most needed, in particular growth industries and sectors, particularly targeting particular apprentices in age groups. I mean, it's just about regionality. That's another dynamic that I think we mustn't lose sight of. So anyway.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think, how do you run an enormous organisation in City and Guilds. How can, and you've got experience of diverse teams and bringing those teams together for certain projects and stuff like that. On a practical side of things, this is a question that is never normally asked probably to you or to anyone really. And it just come into my head.
Probably not going to like it then, am I?
But you know, how can practically like DWP and DFE come together to be able to be sort of joined up in this thinking? What are the practical things that would need to happen? You're a CEO of a huge organisation. From your experience, not teaching them to suck eggs or anything, but yeah, from your experience, how do you bring different diverse teams together?
I mean, it's a great question, Gavin, actually. And look, it's not even something that is pandemic related, although it's more so than ever makes sense to do exactly what you just said, because that's been the holy grail, I think, for decades, actually. How do we actually get the departments of DfE particularly and DWP, and you know, to really come together, and BEIS actually for that matter. It's almost like a triangle.
Yeah, totally.
Actually of BEIS, of DWP and DfE, really working hard to set the agenda. I mean, you know, we talk about everything that comes out of government, rightly so at the moment, around employer responsiveness, but how responsive are they in enabling that happen? And actually the one way that we could make genuine employer responsive happen and really close the huge chasm actually that's often existed between supply and demand is if actually we did have, you know, BEIS, DfE and DWP coming together on their policies and on what needs to happen. I mean, how we do it? I mean, it's, I wish I had the answer. I mean, I think how we're tackling it is by trying to have those right conversations. And in all fairness, I feel like we are being listened to, and certainly we've made really good progress with DWP. I think DWP are working really hard to try and be really flexible and responsive. And I think what we need to do is try and get the data points, the evidence points. I think what we need to try and do is bring it almost down from the kind of highfalutin conversations, dare I say, into practical applications to say, well, look, take someone on universal credit who, regardless of COVID, you would want to try and get off universal credit. Take something like the lifetime guarantee or one of the other initiatives that Kickstart that have been announced recently. How can we connect those two things together and say, right, someone on universal credit, we're now going to give you some sort of additional entitlement for the next 6 months that will then take you from being sort of a customer DWP to being a customer, you might argue, of DfE, if you want to call it that. But actually, how brilliant to have seen, therefore, that movement and therefore the impact that can have, therefore, not just for the two departments, but the social mobility for that particular individual, the productivity aspect of it. You know, I know I'm making it sound all so easy, and we all know it isn't, but you know, joking apart, I think, you know, this just requires people sitting round a table and not necessarily people from within their own departments. I think it is bringing in, and I don't say this in any arrogant way, it is bringing in the experts from the sector. It is bringing in organisations like our own and others that exist and say, let's work this out together. You know, you say what you want to try and create, and then we'll try and work with you to make sure that we can create that. That to me is genuine, joined up ecosystem alignment working really well for the greater cause and the greater good. But I don't know. It's not utopia, I know.
No. And sorry, I just completely threw a curve. I didn't say I was going to. It just came in my head, and I thought I'd ask you. But we know each other well enough that I can.
Yeah, no. Well, I think to be honest, if you hadn't asked me, I think somewhere in our chat today, Gavin, it would have come up, because I think more than ever, the need for those departments to work as one has never ever been more important.
Yeah, 100%. I totally agree. It's just, and what is so exciting, I think, is we used to be really excited if they would mention the word apprentice, or, you know, if, you know, a prime minister actually went near a college, maybe they passed them in their car or something, you know. But, you know, there's big announcements happening in colleges, you know. Yeah. And for us, like for me locally, you know, Exeter College had a big announcement with Boris in it. You know, Rishi's, you know, really, really keen on, yeah, on employability and sort of helping people stay in jobs. This is like our golden opportunity as a sector. I just think it's just so exciting that we just need to be able to work out a way to really be that. I've said it so many times, is that I think the sector can be the vaccine to the long COVID effects on the economy.
I just think it's a good way of looking at it.
How can we sort of deliver that? Can I ask you about the Skills for Jobs white paper, the FE white paper that everyone was long anticipating about? Big, yeah, there's like five big chapters in it. What are your sort of main sort of standout points for you?
Well, look, I suppose we all eagerly awaited it, as you've just said, and you know, the fact it's actually ended up, you know, the shift being Skills for Jobs, I think that was a really good move, actually, because I think what it showed is a real appreciation. This has got to be about providing the right skills in the right moment in time to help people move into jobs. So it, recognizing that clear connection between skills development into meaningful employment, I think was really good. And as you were just saying a moment ago, Gavin, the fact that, you know, the FE sector as a whole, colleges, you know, really being on the map, you know, having that sort of spotlight, it is fantastic and long, long overdue. Although a little disappointing, the fact that it was almost silent on training providers. And for me, the lost opportunity of the white paper is the fact that it wasn't representative of what I'd call the whole ecosystem that exists to make skills for jobs, a really realistic and long-term sustainable program, which is what we need. And so, you know, whilst I want to be really cautiously optimistic about the various nods in the white paper to, for example, the College Business Centres, and we'll come back to those maybe in a moment, to lifelong learning entitlements, you know, a lot of it just felt like it was being kicked into long grass. And I felt there was a lack of vision for me, in terms of how you pull it all together. I mean, it was almost silent also on digital. And yet, what's the one thing we've all been talking about the last sort of nearly 12 months now is how much flipping we all did and pivoting to digital, and how well actually we've adapted to that. You know, as a society, as a community, in various different businesses. And yet, where was that in the white paper? And yet we've got this amazing opportunity to really rethink and reshape how education and skills for the future can be delivered and can be supported. So I think I was probably more disappointed than I was pleased, even though there are definitely some really good green shoots in there that we need to look at how we can now maybe go back and influence and sharpen up. I mean, the fact that the HE-FE connection wasn't made particularly loudly, and yet we all look back on the Augur report, and was it 54 or 52 recommendations that were made in there? There may have been a lot of them, but they were pretty sensible recommendations actually. So I'd be very disappointed if we still don't see some of that playing back through as the months roll on.
Yeah, no, definitely. Can we sort of go into those a little bit more? So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if you look at AELP, they always give a stat, I think it's about 70, 75, depends, percent of their members are the people that actually deliver. AELP members, I think it's like 70-something percent of all AELP members deliver that amount of apprenticeships for the sector, which I'm probably now going to get really hit by Jane, but I've got the stat wrong or something. But the point is that the majority of AELP members are training providers, and they deliver the majority of apprenticeships. And it's just like, you're absolutely right around what does that mean for sort of moving forward. I think what is interesting is the College Business Centres. And I've seen a few of these over the years, actually. Waltham Forest, I think, had a really interesting College Business Centre before, with Arnie Skelton used to run that one. And I think that's really, really interesting. I think that, could there be an opportunity for training providers and colleges to come together? Could this actually be something really, really, really quite cool, where we're getting more employers more engaged and actually clicked in to colleges and the wider ecosystem of the sector? I mean, what could it be if it was a hybrid working environment? Do you know what I mean? Or where you got live, not live work, but you got work learn sort of units and stuff. And what could that mean? Do you know what I mean? So I don't know what your views are around that, around what that could sort of mean for the future.
No, it's a really good point. And actually, I'm not just trying to shamelessly plug it, but it is true that if you go back to reports and work that we did last year, September, and then subsequently in our At Now report that we published in November, where we'd gone round regions. I spent last summer with Anne Milton, actually, the former Skills and Apprenticeship Minister. We hosted a series of roadshows, and we literally virtually travelled to seven regions over the summer, talking to them about what they most needed, both employers, colleges, providers in the room, virtually talking about what could we do. So this is way before the white paper. So maybe some of that did get in there and influence it. Who knows?
I think they're listening. I really do.
I hope so. But I mean, you know, how do we, to your point, connect all this up and also not reinvent, because there's already some great stuff happening on the ground, locally, regionally. And to a certain extent, I think one of the things I didn't say actually about the white paper, it's a very centralist approach. And I think that's unfortunate, because I think what we really need to do is bring the region in. And I think therefore for those centres, whether they're college-based or even wider than that, and I'll come to that point in a moment, they need to be very regionally led. They won't work unless they're very regionally led and influenced. And the reality also is that college-based training isn't for everybody. You know, there needs to be more variety. We need to be able to think about the role of the provider and indeed other provision. And I suppose how I look at it, Gavin, is about how do we take learning to the people and change the sort of sense of space and where learning has to take place. So whilst, of course, colleges absolutely have a fundamental critical role in that, there are other ways and places and spaces that people will want to learn, certainly adults. So, you know, how do we take it onto the high street? How do we give it, how do we give access to it on people's smartphones in their pockets? And therefore, I would, so whilst the, you know, the college business centres were are a good concept. And as I say, we were calling for something similar through our employment and training hubs, even way back last September. I think we need to widen their remit. And as you were suggesting, widen the partnership aspect of who's convened in all of that to make them really fly and to make them really work. And as I said, my biggest point would be, let's make sure we take it to the people out on the streets, not necessarily bring it in to always a physical centre.
Yeah, no, definitely. I 100% agree. With our high streets are changing before COVID. I mean, they're completely transformed
now. What do we use our high streets for now, maybe?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that could be a really, really exciting sort of future that we've got there. And I mean, one thing I would say around how, before we had a bit of a, you know, everyone come to us sort of approach predominantly in the sector, yes, this flipped, isn't it? You know, with digital, it's transformed that, where we're taking learning to the people, and it's actually more, you know, you can pick it up anywhere from your phone to your, you know, any touchscreen device that you want. And that's fantastic. And I think, how can we look at digital within not just the white paper, but the sector moving forward? Because I know you've got loads of views around how can we just make it, like you said, bring in education to the people, bring in opportunities to the people into their own homes on when we can travel again. Wow, those heady days of being on a packed bus. Woohoo! But I've actually having that device that you've got in your hand anyway, and why can't you be learning when you're doing that? And I think like you've also sort of suggested in there as well, there's talk about buildings, but what does it mean when you can't go in them? And around digital, so should we not be investing more in our FE digital real estate rather than just physically in buildings?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, what was it? Was it 1.5 billion was referenced in the white paper? I hope I've got that number right, for investment in capital and infrastructure, you know. And whilst it might not have meant just being buildings, the default position will always be probably.
Yeah.
That form of real estate, whereas as you've so elegantly put it, Gavin, it's actually about the digital real estate and not just the devices. It's the infrastructure, it's the training, the professionalisation that will be needed to help colleges and tutors generally, you know, be able to operate across a much more blended universe of supporting learners. I mean, you could have a student enrolled in a college down in the south whose employer might be in the north, who is actually doing a particular course at another college in the east of England, and actually that could all be accommodated if we were to think very differently about a concept. I was talking to the sector about back in 2014, College Without Walls. Changing the landscape, and it's not, by the way, in any way undermining what colleges are or do or how important they are to the whole ecosystem, but it is actually reimagining how they operate, what they support, and how they share their resources across the whole sector. Because we're all guilty in this sector, actually, of not invented here syndromes. And so, you know, whether it's the awarding sector, whether it's the college delivery sector or the private training provider sector, we all go around inventing and investing in our own versions of very similar things. Where actually, if we thought quite differently about how we co-invest, even though accepting that there are then areas that we have to compete, I think we would probably have a far more dynamic, responsive system. But again, may sound a bit utopian, but...
No, not at all. I think, if you look at like FutureLearn, you look at Coursera, you know, that's a really interesting model. And it will then bring us into, naturally, FE, HE, and that missing middle, level 4 and 5. I think there's a bit of a gap around that. And I mean, there was other reports on the same day, which is interesting, like the interim post-18 review, you know, in sort of everyone else's language, like the Augur review interim.
Or Mark II, yeah.
Yeah, totally. And it's just like, what does that sort of mean, really? And I think, you know, if you're looking at levelling up, if you're looking at social mobility, if you're in a rural area, we do need to be putting more infrastructure in place so actually people have got broadband that they can actually, or data. Digital poverty is a massive thing now. And I think
absolutely.
How can we sort of deliver on that as a sector? And I think, like you said, again, that's sort of linking up different departments potentially, isn't it? You know, not just DfE, but what could we be doing with, BES or whoever, do you know what I mean? There's going to be sort of looking after that. Can we talk about, and this is leading into this sort of next point around level 4-5 and that sort of missing middle area. And it sort of also, it was touched on a little bit before with previous reports around learning loans as well. But I think it sort of then starts to step into lifelong learning a little bit as well. And then I want to talk about your report because this sort of then wraps around loads of different stuff. Yeah, perfect timing on that report. And it's just like... What's your sort of view on that? Because if we're looking at, some learners will be very happy to get a loan to be able to complete the, qualifications that they want. Others will be very reluctant. They can't afford to do it. What's your sort of views around that? How can we help people go from like level 3 into 4 and 5, thinking regional, thinking, the whole social mobility thing, leveling up the whole sort of piece? It seems to be a real big gap there with people being able to move on. What's your views on that?
Yeah, well, I think part of my view on it is you talk about levels. I do think we're a bit obsessed with levels, actually. And, I understand we have to have a currency. I understand that it does provide that sort of framework. But I think probably, again, one of the things that's a byproduct of COVID that probably will continue beyond COVID is it actually about levels or is it about specific skills that are needed at specific moments in time? And then what's the new currency for how we contextualize those? And in many respects, that does, that's very much what was really very much said in the report that we published recently, Building Bridges Towards Future Jobs. So I think the role of loans and having a lifelong learning entitlement does have a place in that, a very good place. And look, I've been very vocal on lifelong learning for many, many years now, and I think our underinvestment in it is at our peril now, actually. It would have been at our peril regardless of COVID, but it is why we are still suffering as a nation in terms of when we look at our skills deficits and shortages. And if we could start to imagine a vision for lifelong learning as an entitlement, where so much for entitlement was obviously completely state free because it's up to a certain age, and that's how it should be. And then how and where does the relationship start to change between what state pays in, a bit like with apprenticeships, states paying in, employers are paying in, individuals aren't. But then at what point does an individual start to pay in as they continue professional development or continue with their career? So I think there is room for a system that would allow us to rethink the whole entitlement of free and state education right through to cradle to grave, where we as individuals are willing to pay in 100% or a percentage, depending at what stage in our career journey. And that might sound a little obscure when the report that we recently published said that only a quarter of individuals right now would be willing to pay for their own learning. Now, you could say only a quarter and read that negatively, or you can go, actually, a quarter are already willing to consider paying. How do we increase that? Well, how we increase that is showing the direct relevance between the learning you do and the earnings and the job opportunity. And I think the more we do that, the more we will find people are willing to invest or co-invest along with state or their employer in their skills and their future in their education. So I sort of took it as a kind of glass half full rather than a glass half empty.
Definitely.
Statistic, if I'm being honest with you, Gavin. And when I think about the number of people now who tragically but desperately are trying to get themselves and transition from one industry, take let's take the airline, I know it gets used a lot, the airline industry, and say, how can I now get myself employed? Where are my transferable skills? You know, the number of people who are now going on to our Step Into Social Care program, which is a transition between one industry into a new industry where there is growth, and would be willing to pay, not huge amounts, but pay for that credential to demonstrate they've got those skills so they become employable. I think there's a lot more mileage for us to drive out from that approach. But what we've got to be able to do, it's not the learning that I think the consumer in that sense or the learner is paying for, it's the end destination.
Yeah, definitely.
We've got to be able to show the correlation between the two.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you're right. I think there's it shows an opportunity for the sector to be able to not be reliant on sort of that magic money tree. Like you said, it doesn't exist, you know, with the country is paying out so much money to be able to, you know, go through this crisis, you know, but more than ever before. Who can imagine that a Conservative government have paid out as much as what they have for the people, really? I was surprised, but I don't know who else was. But it's just
we'll pay
like
it back, Gavin. I think
I think my great great grandkids are going to be paying it back, and it's just like. But I think you're right. I think it's an opportunity for the sector to better step into more of a commercial model there, isn't it? So the loans could be maybe a start, maybe, but it's just it's the end destination, like you're saying. You need to better to show, and I think that's really interesting, particularly coming from your day job. That's really interesting of like sort of be able to show people, look, this, if you get this qualification, it opens up these opportunities. And I think maybe the way that it's sort of we're selling to people and marketing like different qualifications should be around that end destination, the whole stackable skills piece. Absolutely. I know we talked about loads, and I'm a big fan of like just how do we micro credential people to get there so we can you know, tailor it towards their needs and we can then get there. It's almost like I said before, it's like Lego really now, because I've had to stick a bit of a sidebar on to move across. And I think what was interesting in your Building Bridges Towards the Future of Jobs report was one of the stats I saw in there was a third of Britons are worried about starting their career over again. And that's, I understand it, but it's just how can we support those people, and how can we show them that there is an end destination and this is what you could be doing, you know?
No, really good point. Again, I think the report goes, and what I was really proud about with the report, Gavin, is just how much practical detail it went into to demonstrate, you know, where are the at-risk jobs, but more importantly, how can you transition and what would it take? So, for example, take an at-risk job like a bartender. We've got, that's one of the at-risk jobs in there. The public administration sector is growing. There's actually a need for more housing officers, for example. So, and by the way, there's nearly an £8,000 upward lift in your salary earnings if you were to take your skills as a bartender. You might say, well, what are they? Well, you know, customer that translate over into being a housing officer. Well, customer service, ability to look at health and safety and cleaning and staff management and site maintenance, and all of a sudden you go, oh, okay, yeah, there is quite a lot of correlation. Yeah. And we break down in the report, we break down quite a lot of different occupations like that. So what we're trying to do is genuinely give people hope and aspiration about what actually is potentially available and how you make those transitions. But of course, ultimately, it does go back to an old chestnut that again has been, you know, how many times have we, years now, decades, have we been talking about the need for really good quality careers advice and guidance?
100%, yeah.
Because people don't know what they don't know. How many people know that phlebotomy, for by the way, which is in the report, is having a growth of 277% growth at the moment in phlebotomy, you know, which is obviously taking blood. But actually, we know that probably will only be a reasonably short midterm skill level. But actually, to go and get yourself trained as a phlebotomist isn't that out of the question, especially if there are certain areas that you've come from. So how do we actually make that known, and how do we get that out there and help people understand? And that's where you go back to the ecosystem. You know, imagine if the employment training hubs that we've talked about being on the high street, and you've got local employers making that data and insight available, and those centres being able to say, well, actually, look at the skills you have got. Let's now just credential those for you, and then get you this top-up training. And by the way, here's a local employer who's ready to recruit you, you know, right now. And it's that kind of joining up that we need to we need to sort of make happen. And the point about the report, I think it shows it can be done. I mean, data is actually the key to a lot of this, if I'm being really honest, Gavin. I know that might sound dreadfully boring, but actually it's not. I mean, you unlock that data, you unlock a hell of a lot of magic. I mean, for the report, we literally analysed over 65 million job postings to get to the granularity of what's in the report by region. And I think that shows how powerful data is, not just as a tool, but as a real enabler to sort of unlocking some of this. Because how often have we trained people for jobs that aren't really there or are going to be in decline? And we've just got to stop doing that now. We've just got to be really, really forensic on making sure that whatever investment, whether it's my personal investment or the state's or the employer's investment, that our investment is going into training and skills and qualifications that are most needed and matter for the today and future job market.
Yeah, definitely. And I think data, it's a term that I hear over and over and over and over again, but yeah, data, it's only useful once, it's like oil, it's only useful once it gets refined. And I think, honestly, this total plug to MC now and Andy, but I think one of the best, and we did an interview at that conference, actually, one of the best conferences I went to is an MC conference when you was allowed to go to them, because it joined so many people around data, and it was just that underpinning of what can data do. And it's just, I think, it's not boring. It's this insight into what you can sort of do.
Absolutely.
And what's real, not feelings, it's this real. And I think that one of the biggest growth areas is going to be data analysis for everyone, because everyone's going to suddenly tweak. Hang on, every role needs data. Do you know what I mean? We need to work out exactly what we're doing. So I think that's
I probably should just say though, Gavin, for the record, although absolutely MZ and we work a lot with MZ, this was also done with Burning Glass, who were another similar, do something slightly similar to MZ, but I'd probably get shot if I didn't.
Totally. And I walked into that one completely. Yeah, no, so no, sorry.
No, don't be sorry.
Bates is great. Burning Glass, we love you too. It's this,
MZ and Burning Glass. Both of them get a big thumbs up for sure.
But data is key for the sector to be able to work out how to actually deliver on this. And I think that was my point of me just being completely naively walking in once again into another like sort of political storm, sorry, whatever. But it's just the whole point is data is key for this. And I think maybe one thing that we could sort of come out of sort of concluding here really is where we've got National Apprenticeship Week, and we're in lockdown, and it's now more than ever, we've got such an opportunity as a sector, we really, really have. But maybe that joined up approach could be a joining up of data, which then helps DWP, DFE, BRs, I never can say it, and it's just that whole joining of what do employers need, what do we need to educate, how do we help people into those roles. Maybe data is the key here. So I think digital and bringing learning to the people, but that data and how can we give people careers advice and guidance. One thing I wouldn't mind asking you, one last bit, is transferable skills are fantastic, but how do we educate those gatekeepers to be able to know that a bartender could become a very good housing officer? How could we enable someone who is a chef to be able to transfer to being working in social care or in elderly care? How do we educate those gatekeepers?
It's a great question, and actually gatekeepers are often, it's a great term, isn't it? Because they literally are the gatekeepers inside the organisations. It's they can be the people who open up it all up, or the people who close it all down, really. So influencing them is incredibly important. I mean, I genuinely think, and this is one of the, I suppose, if we can say there are any upsides to COVID, really, but I don't know if that's the right way to describe it, but it's this sense of responsibility that we all have collectively. So you take an employer, an employer in a local area who traditionally would always say, well, I only recruit from this particular talent pool. I think there is now a much greater social responsibility on employers to not just think about their own productivity. Of course, that's important to them as well, but to think about what they need to do to contribute to the community at large, and think about fishing, if I can say that, in a broader broader talent pool. And I just said about productivity. Actually, my genuine belief is having a much more inclusive and diverse workforce actually will make you more productive in the end anyway. So the relationship between productivity and social mobility and inclusion and diversity, I think it is yet to be fully explored by all of us in terms of our own organisations. And there's so much more richness that we will be able to get as a result of that. So I think it's just really having really good employers, make sure that they talk to their gatekeepers, their middle managers, and really encourage that active, broader diversity and inclusion agenda as part of their recruitment. I mean, again, in the report that we were talking about a moment ago, Gavin, there's some great case studies in there, but there's one that stands out, Green Sleeves Care, who are obviously a network of social care centres, and they're one of the employers who came straight to the table when we launched the Step Into Care programme, and they've just been brilliant in promoting the fact that they will look at people from all walks of life or experience, as long as the right attitude is there and there's some transferability of skill, because then they can do the sort of top up training and learning as that person goes through their career with them. So that's the kind of attitude we need from our employers across the country, really.
100%. Kirsty, thank you so much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you around what a massive topic covering we've done, but yeah. But I'd love to do it again sometime really soon, and I just wanted to say thank you so much, and thanks for sharing a coffee and a tea with us and exploring the way that the sector can move forward. Thank you so much.
Brilliant. Thanks, Gavin.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Why not click subscribe so you can be informed when the latest next individual podcast or podcast mini series from FE News are going to be released.